Welcome to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Sunbury Press publishes print, electronic, and audiobooks under a variety of imprints and categories available worldwide wherever books are sold. And now your host, the founder and CEO of Sunbury Press, Lawrence Knorr.
I'm talking to you from the Sunbury Press studio at the historic Christian Baker Farm near Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. My guest today is Walter Herbst, the author of It Did Not Start with JFK. He's got two volumes, one and two, and it's about the decades of events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Walter, welcome.
Well, hi, Lawrence. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so a lot to unpack here. We're going back in time to 1963, but I guess with your books, you're really going back way before then. So talk about, you know, why the decades of events. How many strings are attached here? I know you can't give it to us in total, but maybe summarize your premise.
Yeah, sure. Well, first, for 40 years, I've been investigating the JFK assassination. And there were some items I came across that bothered me in my investigation, such as, why is it that when Oswald was arrested there, he asked for John Apt to be his attorney? Now, John Apt was the only man at the time, and only attorney to represent any client in a court of law for violating the Smith Act, which said that an individual could be tried who was part of a group who were advocating the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. Now, Oswald's uneducated high school dropout in Texas, and he knows about this guy John Apt in New York. How is that?
Uh-huh.
And 4 months before, Oswald is at a seminary college in Alabama where his cousin is studying, and he's speaking there. And he's telling these people that a military overthrow coup is possible in the United States. You know, and his writings, he says democracy, communism. He said one was twisted beyond recognition, the other one was decaying and dying. Okay, and then, you know, and I was looking at the assassination itself, and I'm thinking Castro was someone the United States wanted dead for quite some time, right?
Yeah.
People are familiar with the late 1950s, the mafia attempts to try and kill him, what have you. But here to have Oswald, a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, defected to the Soviet Union, goes to Mexico, tried to get into Russia. Everything points to a Cuban connection if they want it, but they don't do it. Okay, and so anyway, so I started thinking, this didn't occur in a vacuum, okay, the assassination. I mean, there were 26 or 15 assassination attempts against other or government overthrows against leftist governments around the world within 26 months of JFK's assassination. So I started thinking, let me go back in time and see if I can find any connection between history and the assassination. So it brought me back to the 1920s, and it really starts with anti-communism and a desire in the United States to maintain a way of life, at least from the elite point of view. There was a pseudoscience at that time, eugenics, that said that from your blood you could tell an individual's ability to either be of value to society or a drain on society. The United States even got involved at the time in forced sterilizations, passing immigration laws, and basically to restrict immigration from Northern Europe into the United States. And I mean, as you go through time, into it has a direct connection to the right wing objection to the civil rights movement in the 50s. But that was a small part of it. What happened then was at the time of the Depression, there were groups called the Century Group, which is made up of people like John McCloy, who was probably the most unknown famous person of the 20th century, who served president after president and was one of the leaders on the Warren Commission. And these people wanted to maintain a way of life. They saw what FDR was doing, that FDR was New Deal was taking money away from them against their will. They thought it was a violation of their constitutional rights, and they wanted to stop it. And so it led to some attempts against FDR, assassination attempts and trying to remove him from office. So that's basically where it started. As far as going back to that time, and then there's a whole series of events that go up from decade to decade as we get closer to the assassination. That you can see, just lead you to it.
So it's not like there's one character like a J. Edgar Hoover lurking for 50 years that's controlling everything like a spider in his web. It sounds more like it's a culture or an environment that fosters this belief, this kind of thinking. And it almost sounds like you're talking about the WASP elites, like out of your elite universities and out of the high-ranking military.
100%. I mean, if I were to look and see from that point on, and you can see there's an involvement of it all.
Now, let me just sure challenge you, though. There's nobody who's been president that probably falls in line with that better than JFK, who comes from a very wealthy New England family. Same with the Roosevelt line. So I guess, is it seen that these people betrayed sort of the more traditional conservative values?
100%. Mm-hmm. 100%. I mean, starting with, say, FDR first, I mean, at the time, you had very wealthy people in who were not, again, supporting people who were lesser mean, but they didn't like the idea of being told they had to do it. They looked at the United States Constitution and even the Declaration of Independence, that they had a God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Really, pursuit of happiness was taken from John Locke, the English philosopher, pursuit of property.
Mm-hmm.
And they just didn't like being told that this is what they had to do. And JFK, I mean, by the time JFK became president, there were so many things he was doing that were against what and to call it right wing is really it's a misnomer, because it's not. Today we have a different idea of what right wing is than back then. Right wing transcended party politics. It was basically people who were anti-communist, who were elites, and then were objected to anyone who tried to violate certain tenets that they thought the United States had to maintain. One was the policy of containment. After World War II, George Kennan was a U.S. diplomat stationed in Moscow, and he was very much anti-Russian, saw what was happening, saw what they were capable of. So President Truman asked him to send a telegram just explaining, giving his thoughts on Russia. And he spent 5,000 or sent a 5,000-word telegram outlining the dangers of communism and the Soviet Union. But he came back in the end, he established what was called the policy of containment.
Yep.
And the idea was to basically put a ring around Russia and China, contain them, don't let them expand their communism, and eventually it would self-implode because their economies would not be able to sustain what was necessary to keep their countries going. In the 1980s, kind of what happened to the Soviet Union, right? It took a little longer than they expected,
yeah,
but it did self-implode. Okay, so JFK did a lot of things that violated this policy of containment, such as he wanted to normalize relations with Russia. He wanted to normalize relations with Castro. He wanted to pull out of Vietnam, which was important because it was a spread of communism. He, even with the civil rights movement, that he wanted to proceed along those lines. These were people who still clung to the idea that you had to maintain a level of or restrict the people in this country to Northern Europeans, and of course Kennedy was not going to do that, and he sold wheat to the Russians and a bunch of other things, such as missile crisis they thought he didn't handle correctly.
All right.
And so he really set himself up for the opposition to really take an aggressive stance against him.
All right, well, let's hold that thought. We're talking to Walter Herbst, the author of It Did Not Start with JFK. We'll be right back.
The BookSpeak Network brings you history through biography. Sunbury Press Books founder and publisher Lawrence Knorr hosts this program that takes a look at pivotal figures in American history, including the famous, the infamous, and the not-so-well-known. Lawrence is joined by Joe Farrell and Joe Farley, authors of the Keystone Tombstone series of books, available at sunburypress.com. History through biography, here on the BookSpeak Network.
I'm back with Walter Herbst, the author of It Did Not Start with JFK. Walter, as you were saying in the first segment, it seems like JFK was setting himself up by being against the grain in many ways. And, you know, these days were before my time, so I can only study them as an historian, not firsthand. But, you know, whatever the reason somebody pulled the trigger, it was an assassination of a president of the United States. It was one of the worst crimes in our nation's history, if not the worst crime. I mean, there were others that were assassinated too. You know, my perspective, what really got me interested as a young person, just besides the fact that JFK was a very charismatic leader, was the Ruby thing. Like, here comes Oswald. You know, he's been caught. Somehow he's been caught quickly. And then he's assassinated himself within a few days. And that just smells of a conspiracy. So I'm going to kind of pull you back to, all right, the events happened. Talk a little bit about the soup that we're in here in Dallas in November 1963. What's going on with Ruby and why is he taken out Oswald?
Right. I think anyone who knows anything about Jack Ruby and thinks that he shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald because he didn't want Jackie Kennedy to come back to Texas and testify has to think conspiracy. I mean,
right.
Ruby was a strip club owner, a thug, mafia connected. Throughout the decade before, he was running guns. He was trafficking in drugs for the Marcello crime family out of Louisiana. When Santos Trafficante was in detained in Cuba, after Santos being the leading mafia figure from Miami and in Cuba, but was detained by Castro, and they were trying to get him out. Ruby, who sent to Cuba to assist in that effort. Meanwhile, he approached the FBI, became an informant, and went out and bought himself wires and things, you know, secret hidden microphones. And there's so much to this man, and then there's something else that is really important. Sorry, Jack Ruby. Now, when his lawyer, after he killed Oswald, and his lawyer said to him that anyone that you're concerned about, the people learning about. And he mentioned one person, that was Thomas Eli Davis. Now, the interesting thing about Thomas Eli Davis was he was a gun runner with Ruby to send guns to cash. But Thomas Eli Davis was important. Goes way beyond that. Now, Davis, at the time of the assassination, was an American mercenary. He was organizing an army to try and invade Haiti. And interestingly enough, there was someone else involved in Haiti at the time, and it was George de Morenschein, who, people who are familiar with the Oswald story know that George was an aristocratic white Russian who came to the United States, had Nazi connections, and mentored Lee Harvey Oswald from the moment he returned from Russia. George Morenscheid is in Haiti. He's with a CIA operative named Charles Norberg, who had a history of mind control experimentation with the CIA. And you know, he was close to a fellow named George Hunter White, who was on loan from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to the CIA. Now, 16 days after the assassination, our friend Thomas Eli Davis gets arrested in Tangier. And he gets arrested because he has on his, in his possession a letter of introduction to a person named Oswald, and it references the assassination. Well, it turns out that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, it was Victor Oswald. And Victor Oswald also had CIA connections. And he was an arms dealer that was in Madrid. And there was a group in Madrid, this international right-wing fascist group throughout the 50s, that involved some, believe it or not, I mean, you sometimes you start to spread this too wide, and it gets people think it's unbelievable, but it really isn't. There were ex-Nazis that were in Madrid, and we know this was after the, and Franco was in power already, so it was a fascist country. One of whom was Douglas MacArthur's chief intelligence officer, Charles Willoughby, who he called my little fascist. And it also involved people from the United States who were Texas oil men, businessmen. And a private intelligence organization that was created by CIA Director Alan Dulles before he was CIA Director, and William Donovan, who was the head of OSS, the intelligence group during World War II. And so there's like this full circle, almost like an international potential for the people who are responsible for the assassination. And somehow Jack Ruby is associated with this through Thomas Eli Davis.
That's interesting. I mean, yes, you can go really wide and then you just get lost in this web, this confusing web. And that's just the way that intelligence and spy networks work. Nobody knows the whole story. Everybody has just a piece. And it's almost impossible to investigate and piece together because you hit all kinds of dead ends. And then it starts to look like a wacky conspiracy theory if you go too wide, right?
So,
exactly. But yeah, let's pull it back in, though. It's who was in the grassy knoll then? Was there a grassy knoll shot? You know, these kinds of questions come up with people who just follow the JFK assassination, maybe lightly, just have a little bit of knowledge about it, might know the Zapruder film, or maybe saw that movie JFK, which has a lot of angles to it, a lot of threads, some of them fictional. But it gets so complicated. But the bottom line to me is somebody fired a gun at the president and killed him. Probably three shots. They probably came from different directions. Probably wasn't just one guy. And then the guy who's accused of it gets killed by a mafia guy. So it just, you know, when you just take those basic facts, it smells of a conspiracy. And so, but we've been debating it for 60 years. So, yeah.
It's amazing that, first of all, the single bullet theory, which you're alluding to, it's fiction.
Yeah.
If you think from these terms that JFK's still on a private, by Sunday, J. Edgar Hoover's over it now, but I don't think J. Edgar Hoover was involved in the assassination, but he certainly was involved in the cover-up, and I think he may have had some idea what was happening. But by Sunday, he's already saying that one person, Oswald, from the sniper's nest, three shots. Okay, and so that's, and by that time the autopsy is already done. And people at the autopsy had a problem. There's a wound in JFK's back, low on his back, and when they probed it, it wouldn't go all the way through. They put the probes in, their fingers in, and it sealed up. And they didn't know about the throat, the throat wound that JFK had, but in Dallas they performed a tracheotomy to just make every effort to hopefully save him. And
right.
That was obliterated. They weren't aware. So they found out then about the bullet on the stretcher by making some phone calls. Right. There was that pristine bullet, Commission Exhibit 399, was found on the stretcher at the hospital in Dallas, at Parkland Hospital. So they said, okay, that answers it. That was the shot that went into his back, cardiac massage, the bullet fell out. Then another, you know, then all, Connolly got shot by all the other bullets, and the third one killed JFK in the head. Well, what they didn't know at the time was that there was a person named James Teague standing along the curb, and one of the three shots missed the limo.
Yep.
Hit the curb, splintered, and hit him in the face. Right. Right. So now you wind up with two bullets. One of them obviously killed JFK and had the kill shot. And it was from the front. It was nothing but.
Walter, we're going to have to take a break. We'll be right back. Let's hold on to those thoughts about where the bullets are coming from. Talking to Walter Herbst, it did not start with JFK.
Sunbury Press Books opens the door to Pennsylvania Dutch and German history with our imprint, Distel Fink Press. Find out about the lives of figures in early American history through the Muhlenbergs of Pennsylvania, or Conrad Weiser, Friend of Colonist and Mohawk by Paul A. Wallace, Joseph G. Rosengardens, the German Soldier in the Wars of the United States, or the Indians of Berks County by D.B. Bruner. Check out the wide variety of available works, both fiction and nonfiction, at sunburypress.com.
I'm back with Walter Herbst discussing It Did Not Start with JFK. Apologize for the interruption as the bullets were flying. Walter, maybe you could bring us back to that horrendous moment. You were talking about a third shot and somebody on the curb.
Yeah, so just to briefly wrap it up, they wound up with one shot missed and two bullets had to do all the damage if it was one long gun. One of those bullets had to hit Kennedy in the head. So that means Connally, Governor Connally's wounds and all the wounds to Kennedy through his throat, back and what have you, had to be from the sniper's nest, one bullet. And the things didn't line up, so they raised one of the bullets up, the back wound up to make it line up. But the kill shot from the front.
Yeah.
Definitely from the front. And not from the back end. Just the way that Kennedy's head reacted, where the blood went, how the motorcycle cops on the left rear corner were covered with blood and brain matter. Life magazine, within a week after the assassination, and anyone who's seen this Bruder film knows what I'm about to tell you is just a blatant lie. Mm-hmm. At that point, the Zapruder film was locked up until, I think, 67, 68. But Life magazine, the writer Paul Mandel writes that JFK is seen turning around and facing the sniper's nest and waving as he waves to the crowd, which never happened. So, you know, what was their motivation to do that?
Yeah, so who's the ultimate question? Who is in the grassy knoll? And
There's been a number of theories about that. There's just Jean Soitre, Frenchman, another Frenchman, and there was an alliance between CIA and French intelligence at the time because of the war in Algiers, where the French generals rebelled against the French government because they were granting Algeria independence. And their connection with the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States as well. But that's one person, and Badge Man is someone that they refer to, and there's a Roscoe White. There's a number of cases. No one can really put their finger on it. There's been mafia, hitmen, but one knows for sure who.
Whoever it was a great shot. It was a sniper who was. I mean, because it didn't take, it wasn't like spraying machine gun fire across a crowd and getting lucky. This was somebody that shot a moving target, had a kill shot on a moving target. So somebody who probably trained as a military sniper or very adept through personal experience. But
100%.
Yeah. So 100%. Anyway.
This was a sniper, a trained sniper. Yeah.
Professional hit.
A professional sniper, right.
Yeah, or governmental. A lot of these guys are ex-military. So, as part of my doctoral studies, I was fascinated to kind of study the origins of the Cold War. And a lot of the things you're talking about, the anti-communism, definitely a real break with our Soviet allies who had been betrayed by the Nazis in World War II, become our allies in World War II, but always at arm's length. We never really trusted them. nor did they trust us, but we wanted to defeat the Nazis in Europe, and so did so. But the relations really are very tense, and of course, from there on, we have a Cold War. Key players in that, Alan Dulles is certainly one, and we recently did a chapter in our Keystone Tombstones book about a guy named James McCord, who mysteriously was buried in Reading, Pennsylvania, near my old hometown, actually close to my old neighborhood. And I thought, this guy was living here the whole time. And he was involved he lived there, but he was buried in Indiantown Gap. He was involved with Watergate and thought, okay, well, that's pretty cool. But as we researched him and dug in, we find he's associated with some people like a Frank Sturgis and some others that go back to questions about the JFK assassination and are sort of in league with Nixon and Eisenhower and this Alan Dulles, who was the head of the CIA. So I was really intrigued to learn that Dulles referred to McCord as his best guy. And that was quite a statement. But McCord has such a quiet history, you almost can't find out what this guy did his whole life.
And those are the dangerous ones, you know?
And then my intuition said, you know, and just kind of as a joke, but maybe not, maybe he was in the grassy knoll. I have no idea if he was a sharpshooter or not, and I'm just saying that because he had such a, let's just say, a opaque career. But maybe somebody like that very well could have been involved. And it does seem like there's connections all the way up to Watergate with some of these guys. Did you come across anything like that?
Yeah, you know, just to elaborate a little bit more about James McCord. The listeners who weren't aware, he was one of the ones arrested in the Watergate burglary and served time for it. But his name first appears in the early 1950s, and I could find him. And there was a fellow named Frank Olson, who worked at Frederick, Maryland, at Camp Dietrich, yeah, involved in mind-altering drug experimentation, and which was, especially after the Korean War, there was talk about the Chinese doing that in the United States, felt they were getting behind, and so they wanted to match that anyway. So there were detention camps still from the Nazis in Germany, Camp King in particular, and also went over there and saw what they were doing with his research and work, and was against it, didn't like it. So he came back and basically wanted out, and they got together at a weekend retreat, and they slicked him and a couple other guys, LSD, and it had a terrible effect on Olson, and they were afraid what he was going to disclose. Anyway, it's been proven he didn't commit suicide. He was thrown out of a 13-story window in Manhattan. It was a Willard Hotel, but that's not important. And so I bring it up because he had two guys to a room at the time, and the one guy, the other CIA guy, he calls it in. And the guy knocks on the door on behalf of the CIA to investigate this thing is in court.
Interesting.
Okay. Now, the other thing is, when the police took this guy, I can't remember the other guy's name, I think it was Eastbrook, it doesn't matter, they checked his pocket. He had in his pocket the name George Hunter White, which is a name I referenced to previously, who was associated with Thomas Eli Davis and involved in mind-altering drug experimentation on loan from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to the CIA. So this McCord, he kind of hovers around in the background.
Yeah,
throughout everything. You know, he's close to Sturgis, as you said, another Watergate burglar. He's close to Hunt, another Watergate burglar. And you see the connection from the 1950s up to the assassination, up to Watergate, of the same name.
Isn't that weird that the same guy kind of goes through that thread for 20-some years? Yeah, it is interesting.
Really, really. Yeah, you know, and Sturgis and Hunt, you know, Hunt, Liberty Magazine, I can't remember that, but I sued them because they said Hunt was in Dallas on the day of the assassination. He sued them in the court of law and lost. The facts were against him. And there was this Marita Lorenz, a Cuban exile, who claimed that there was a caravan of guns going from Florida to Dallas and involving Hunt, Sturgis, and a host of others.
Mm-hmm.
And that she got nervous. They sent her back, and next thing you know, she got killed. Now, that doesn't mean that caravan necessarily part of the assassination, but, you know, it kind of, consider the names involved, something's happened, right? I mean, why would you guys show up in Dallas the same day that the assassination's happening? And, so McCourt, he's just...
He just seems to show up, doesn't he? I'm wondering if he...
Up, but you know what, he's not...
But he's never charged with anything until Watergate.
Never charged with anything, other than that Watergate thing.
Yep.
But he's always there, but he's in the back.
You know what's interesting, too? He was let out of prison early, because he copped the deal, and then he lived peacefully in Exeter Township, Pennsylvania, near the Arrowhead Golf Course, in a lovely home. And, well, we included him in our book. Walter, we're just about out of time, but, you know, we've talked here for almost a half an hour, and I don't think we've solved anything except to say that people should read your books about this and go a little deeper into this and find even some more connections that maybe they hadn't thought of. I am going to close with one last question, though, and hopefully you can answer it in a minute or so. Was Lee Harvey Oswald a patsy?
Yes.
Well, that's a simple yes-no answer.
And I can, if you want, I can just elaborate on a couple of things quickly.
Yeah.
Something I think many people don't know about is that, what is known is that when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested in the Texas Theater, he had on his possession a wallet with his identification, his Department of Defense ID card, and a Selective Service card in the name of A.J. Hiddell, the alias he allegedly used. Well, what people don't know about is that there was a second wallet found at the scene of the Tippit murder, the police officer that was killed allegedly by a similar wallet, Department of Defense ID card, a Selective Service card for A.J. Hiddell. Okay? It was buried at the time. It came out 50 years later. It was a local Dallas news team that went out and filmed it. And you see the cops standing there looking through them.
Huh.
And they then interviewed the cops who were still alive, and they said, yes, that's what they found. It was Oswald. Now, how is it possible that he would have two?
Well, he's got one for his left pocket, one for his right.
Yeah, but that's true. So
I'm just kidding.
No, I know you are, but here's here's 2 points. One, if we have time, why did they... That wallet at the scene of the crime was a slam dunk that Oswald was guilty if you went with it. Why bury that one? The second one is, here's what I think the plan was. Get Oswald out of town. He wasn't supposed to get caught. They had this dummy wallet, drop it at the site. Oswald's gone. Maybe they take him out of town. Who knows where? Maybe they kill him, or maybe even they send him to Mexico. Who knows? And they find this wallet with his credentials at the scene, and well, hell,
we're broken. And then Ruby has to whack him because Oswald wasn't supposed to get caught. That makes
exactly.
more sense.
And if you follow the weekend for Ruby, at first when he finds out what's going on, he goes to his sister's house and he goes into the bathroom and he vomits and he's all upset. Sure.
Yeah.
And there comes a point where he thinks he's going to get away with it. And they're getting calls on the phone from the police and from reporters and basically saying, that Oswald's going to get killed tomorrow. And no one knows for sure, but the cop on the other line says that was Ruby. He was trying to get out of it, and he thought he could get out of it, but
interesting.
That's going to be a future book, just Jack Ruby alone, because he's a fascinating story.
Yes, I look forward to seeing that. Walter, we're out of time. It's been great having you on. We'll have you back.
Very good. Thanks, Lawrence. I've enjoyed it very much.
All right. We've been talking to Walter Herbst, the author of It Did Not Start with JFK. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Check out our website at www.sunburypress.com for our latest releases. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter to receive special offers and discounts.